Yes, I mean, the caution, the health warning is, I mean, I'm astonished that house prices have gone up 400-500% in Auckland. Is that over how many years?
Maybe years.
I mean, no democratic society can survive that kind of inequality and also poverty as well. And what you've got is a first-rate housing bubble, haven't you?
An extreme bubble at the moment, yeah. Because we've got also outside, people can come in from overseas and buy land and do land banking, and this is what they're doing.
Yeah.
And artificially blowing up everything.
But as a democracy, as citizens and the government have created a set of rules allowing people to do that. So your rules, your regulations, your laws about land and planning have actually facilitated that bubble. So on the macro level, on the national level, you need to have a serious conversation about planning and land access. Otherwise, that bubble will continue and inequality will get worse. I mean, the big issue I've come across is intergenerational inequality. And so these young people who are building tiny houses, which is a healthy reaction to a pathological land system.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. If you're looking for a house or a home and you want to be part of a greater community and you want to be able to share, cooperate, collaborate and work together and have fun and allow your children or your grandchildren to be with you, to be able to play in the garden, to have a lot of joy in your life and feel at one with the land, allow the wind to blow on your face, the sun to shine and smile on you, this interview may be able to assist you to nestle back closely into the environment. On the phone from Littleton, I have Martin Large. He is from the UK and he's a director of the Stroud Commonwealth in UK, founded in 1999, to develop cooperatives, small businesses and community land trusts. He also is the founder, publisher, director of Hawthorne Press Limited and is a visiting lecturer at the University of Kent and a long-time supporter of biodynamics. So, kia ora and welcome to the other side of our planet, Martin.
Kia ora. It's great to come and study and learn from all the great things happening in New Zealand. I liken our current situation to a tarmac road, the neoliberal tarmac road that is breaking up now. You know, there's all these crises, and in amongst all the cracks, there are all kinds of green shoots coming up to form a new Commonwealth society. And here I am in Littleton, where it's happening everywhere. So it's great to be here, Tim.
That's fantastic. Yes, Littleton is the microcosm for New Zealand in many ways. And I encourage anybody to go to their website, Project Littleton, or littleton.net.nz, to really see and understand that positive change can really happen at a grassroots level.
Yes, and also, I mean, we talk about global warming and climate destruction, and what I'm learning here is this shock of these two earthquakes here and how your community has recovered so successfully and is still working on that. But also, does this prefigure the challenges we face with climate destruction if we don't take timely action? So that's a question I've got.
Very much so. Well, we have been in the throes of a neoliberal government for the last 9 years, and one of the things that they discarded was using the word sustainability in an ecological context. And for the last 9 years, we have sort of gone into a very laissez-faire situation when we really have to factor our children and grandchildren into the equation for tomorrow to make sure that we play our part in finding ways to sequester excess CO2, but also reforest and start new energy systems. I think the Tesla battery situation has possibilities,
yeah.
though it's still going to throw up more cars on the roads.
Yeah.
But anyway, you're here, Martin, in New Zealand. What is the general thrust of what you're wishing to share, other than to pull the strings of community closer together?
Yes. So firstly, I've been talking about community land trusts and how community land trusts can help take care of the commons of land and water and air and so on, but mainly land for farming and housing. And secondly, how can we, you talked about neoliberal economics, was it Rogernomics and Ruthanasia?
Those are the two words.
That's right. So had this huge pendulum swing from, if you like, state-dominated government, social democracy, to the market society, the market state, with neoliberal economics. So they've got this big pendulum swinging. And my question is, goes backwards and forwards, and my question is, the second big theme is how can we rebalance society by inviting not just the public and private sectors into society, but also the plural sector, the civil society sector, like what you see in Project Littleton, to balance. So, you know, I have these two different themes here.
One of the things that New Zealand was in many ways based on cooperatives. We also had mutual insurance societies,
right,
which were really huge. We had building societies and trust banks. We had trust banks right up and down the country. Now we've only got two, one in Southland and one in Taranaki. And we had trust hotels and co-ops or alcohol trusts too, so that if you went and bought alcohol up here in Auckland, you have to buy it from a trust. And,
right.
And what they do at the end of the year, they spin out over $1 million to all the different sports people, any NGO that's doing things for children, or the environment, the Life Saving Association. They used to do it for, once upon a time, give money to the zoo. And to
wow.
The, yes. And
wow.
This is...
So it was a kind of cooperative commonwealth in those days.
That's right. New Zealand, until Rogernomics, 1984, when essentially the right-wing bankers infiltrated
yes.
the Labour Party of all groups. And this is what we've got now, is we've just got a very private-orientated banking yeah. and business system
yeah.
when it was once something so much more people-friendly, and New Zealanders had a stake in their own country.
Yeah, that's a wonderful picture you give of this cooperative commonwealth that you had, and the cooperative values of self-help, self-responsibility, community benefit, community participation, openness, transparency, you know, and community investment. It's a wonderful picture. So what happened to that cooperative commonwealth? Why did it just, you know, fall over like that?
It was, in many ways, the story, the narrative was hijacked, that you cannot really depend on people working together because corporates have got better systems in place.
Yes.
They have got their experts at marketing. And that's what they were doing. And they used very well-timed propaganda
yeah.
to essentially take the narrative and run with it. And
yeah.
so, but New Zealanders have forgotten it. It's over 30 years now since all this happened.
Yeah.
And there's so many younger generation who got no idea of this wonderful commonwealth of cooperation.
Yeah, because what happened in the 90s and early 2000s was many of the building societies in Britain... that were member-owned and mutuals, that's building societies for savings and loans and mortgages, were privatised, and then they went bust.
That's it.
And we shelled out £1 trillion to support them in 2007-08. I bank with the Nationwide Building Society, which is the largest mutual, still member-owned, so some went on, and they're more efficient and more effective and provide better service than our banks, which are basically... the big five banks, a casino bank.
That's right. Mm.
So I had to give a talk in Newcastle-upon-Tyne at a big cooperative conference on the cooperative commonwealth. I described Newcastle-upon-Tyne in a similar way as you've described New Zealand, you know, all these cooperatives. And they arose in the 19th century and early 20th century to counter liberal laissez-faire economics, didn't they? Do you remember all that? The 19th century. So all these... the Workers' Educational Association, we had a People's Theatre in Newcastle, we had a cooperative retail society, we had the Trustee Savings Bank. You know, that whole cooperative commonwealth happened. It was one of the way of pushing back that old liberal, laissez-faire, dog-eat-dog world. And then we've seen that, you know, undermined by Roger economics and neoliberal model. And now the challenge is, how can we reinvent it? How can we recreate it? That's what I see as a big question.
It is a big question. And this is where I feel that people are really keen to be involved. First, we've got to commit, and then we take action. I think we need more skills in basically laying out. We need a real good template.
Right. Well, one template I'd like to introduce is Stroud Commonwealth, we enable social businesses, and so we're very interested in local food. So we enabled the development of one of the first of six community-supported agriculture co-ops just outside Stroud in Gloucestershire, where we live. So community-supported agriculture is a good example of a consumer cooperative who commit to buying produce from farmers a year in advance. So we guarantee their incomes for a year. And so there's 290 of us in this cooperative, and we have a budget meeting every year, and we agree with the farmers what should be grown, and we support the farmers, whether it's feast or famine. You know, you can't plan on the weather.
True.
Often. And so Stroud Community Supported Agriculture is now an exemplar of this very different way of running a farm. And now in the UK, there are over 200 of these CSAs. Some of them are just ordinary box schemes, but a lot of them are like what we had envisaged, which is a real cooperative model. So that's been a real growing point, I guess, for you in New Zealand as well, or is it less known here?
From my standpoint, I don't know a lot about that. There's a lot of farmers' markets, and there's a lot of discussion with the farmers, and I know there was Ubi out of our own backyard here in Auckland, and there are numerous people who will buy and cooperate together to get goods, say, from a big holistic or organic wholesaler.
Right. So you've got these food cooperatives like what you just described. You've got farmers' markets, which are great, and then we've got CSAs, or community-supported agriculture co-ops. And then Ubi, I think, is a world-class exemplar in the making that you've got. I met Peter Russell of Ubi in Auckland.
Okay.
He described how it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in fact what we've been trying to do in Stroud, but our software I don't think is as good as Peter Russell's.
Ooh.
And Ubi, and I think that's one of the things I'm going to take back with me to Stroud Food Hub, to compare and contrast the Ubi approach to the approach we've taken, because that's leading edge. And what Ubi are also doing is they're looking at how ownership can be distributed amongst the founders and customers and producers. And so they're trying to develop new, I don't know if it's going to be cooperative or what, but, you know, they're exploring new ownership forms so that the wealth created by that network can be reflected in that. Yes, a real green shoot, isn't it?
Yes, I've interviewed Pete a number of times recently, though. And there's another thing, too, that's in Auckland here. We have Gardening for Health, which is part of a health initiative from the New Zealand government. And we've got 65 gardens here across Auckland, and seven have just been started up since January of this year. And there are also something like about 641 backyard gardeners all working together as well. And there's a great number of Asian people who have come to New Zealand realising that they can actually work in gardens and work together with so many different people coming together. So the whole initiative, just at that smaller level from the microcosm of Auckland, shows it could be done on a greater scale across the whole country.
Indeed. And Ubi, of course, gives a channel for distributing the surplus from that. And I have an allotment. You know what an allotment is? It's kind of community garden, but every city, every town provides allotments for people. It's an eighth of an acre. And I have this allotment with my mate Andy, and of course we always grow too many lettuces, don't we?
Always. One hit.
And then they bolt because you can't eat them.
Yes.
Right. But so we started, just to continue the story, we started Stroud Community Supported Agriculture as an exemplar, and now that's gone national. And then we had a question from CSAs to say it's difficult getting land. And usually they're organic or biodynamic or sustainable or permaculture, something like that. They need land for the long term, you know, because 7 years, 14 years longer. So we started up a Community Farmland Trust Action Research Project. We got some funding for that. And we enabled farmers and communities to buy land and put it into a farm trust. Are you with me?
Yes, CAs. I'm just wanting to... You mentioned the two letters, CA. I don't know what that means.
Community Supported Agriculture. That's a CSA.
Okay, thank you.
So the CSAs needed land, and so we set up this project to look at that. So one exemplar, one template, two young farmers, Ben and Charlotte, aged 19 and 21, approached us, and they were third-generation tenants of an organic farm estate, and the estate wanted to sell their farm. And I think the estate wanted to sell their farm for a lot of money to a big multinational yogurt company over the wall, right?
Yes.
Anyway, they approached us, and we set up a cooperative called an Industrial and Provident Society. It's an old cooperative form for owning land and assets. And with their friends and the whole community, it was Market Drayton in Shropshire, we got the health authority, the education people, women's groups, local restaurants, a whole load of people in the community, farmers' organizations, and we raised, this is in 2004-05, we raised £800,000 from people investing in shares. So some people bought 100 shares for £100, some people bought 5,000 shares for £5,000. And after, I think it took us 6 months to raise £850,000 from 8,000 people. Okay. And we put the money and the land into a land trust, and it's called Ford Hall Farm. It's a great place. And that started the farmland trust, if you like, small movement in the UK. Yeah.
Yes, that's fantastic. So what happens there? There's two people, and there's all the 8,000 shareholders.
Right.
How does this eventuate?
Well, the 8,000 shareholders are all members of the farmland trust, and they elect a board of trustees, directors. And then there's a contract, a lease between the land trust and the farmers. The farmers run the farm. And the land trust runs lots of educational and social things, environmental things. And that there was half a job on the farm when we started assisting them. And now there's 27 jobs.
Oh, that's very good. And how many hectares?
It's 123 acres, about 60 hectares. Yeah.
Okay.
Which is astonishing. So, to continue the cooperative development line, Cooperatives UK are the trade body set up to facilitate co-op development, to change legislation, all that sort of stuff. Anyway, they saw what we'd done, and they then rolled out a whole program of development, and now there are several thousand similar industrial and provident societies, also called community benefit societies, set up for renewable energy, for owning the village pub or owning the village shop. So that was from a standing start.
Yes.
And we were the only one that did it in 2005-06.
So there's real good possibilities at the moment. It's just how we organize and think outside the box.
That's right. And the organization... Charlotte, the young farmer, very talented woman, you know, when I saw she had a first class honours degree in maths or something, I thought, ooh. And she said, Martin, what we want is a structure, an organisational and legal structure that involves people, helps people reconnect with the land through buying shares, and is a structure for investment. And so this old cooperative form was ideal for that. And, of course, it needs renewing every year, you know, with festivals and courses and making the annual general meeting a festive event so that a lot of the members come.
That's a good idea. I think it's a very good idea.
Yeah.
We have to involve people, and it hasn't got to be all left-brain stuff. We've got to have some right brain and play and getting to know people so that, as you say, a festival is a wonderful way to get people to come to the annual general meeting.
That's right. And this connection with the land you talked about, I think a lot of urban people and rural people want to reconnect with the land, and they don't know how. So there are artistic workshops, that there are things for people that like birds and biodiversity, there's interpretative walks, there's the permaculture people do fantastic design workshops. And so I went on to found the Biodynamic Land Trust after helping an organic farmland trust develop. And so we do design workshops with people walking the land and, you know, looking at what's there and what's trying to emerge in terms of spaces for food growing or education or horticulture or bees. And people love it.
Yes, I think I'm finding that I have my own organic garden, actually. This time, 40 years ago, I was actually doing a course in Findhorn in Scotland.
Oh, wow.
And so, yes, I'm fairly well embedded now, which is really good.
Yeah.
And one of the things is having my garden. And I've got so many greens, particularly in my garden, and I use all the different types of seaweeds, and I can access all sorts of things. And so I know that once we start eating the food that springs out of the soil, we have this connection to the land, that we have this sheer love and reverence for what springs out of the ground.
And also, organically and biodynamically grown food is full of vitality. You know, it gives us energy and helps clear our minds, and that's really important. So the food revolution is the local food revolution. It's a cultural revolution in terms of spiritual connection with the land and a new food culture. It's also an economic revolution in terms of cooperatives, isn't it?
Very much so. And we're looking at how we share from time banks in particular to green dollars. And you know, I encourage people to look up our website, because, and also Project Littleton does time banks very well. And there are so many opportunity for us. First, we have to commit, and then we organise ourselves from then on.
Yes, that's right. And that's why these cooperative forms, you know, you invest your money or your time, are so important, because that, you know, it's a sort of commitment, isn't it? Yeah, so Green Planet FM has lots of resources on your website. Is that right, Tim?
That's right, greenplanetfm.com. All they have to do is go up and do a search, and there's over 400 hours of interviews.
Yeah. So what might be of interest to listeners is the you know, to talk a bit about the trust model for housing, not just for farming. Would that be of interest?
I'm sure everyone would be very interested, because housing has just gone out of so many people's reach. And also the ways we can build, from hay bale to rammed earth to all sorts of different ways in which. So please, Martin, tell us as much.
Yeah, so the whole idea of community land trust is based on looking at land not as a commodity, which we buy and sell on the market, but as a commons to be stewarded, for each community to steward its land commons for community benefit. And of course, if you do it that way, you need a legal structure, a trusteeship body that holds that land. And I think in New Zealand, folk may not understand that land is a bundle of rights. It's like a bundle of sticks. So I'll give you an example. You know, you have this notion of absolute ownership, don't you, here?
That's right. Even though we only have the top of the surface, we don't go right to the center of the planet like supposedly they do in America.
You don't have the mineral rights here, you mean?
That's right. It's
or fracking. Oh gosh. Anyway, so I'll use an example of this bundle of rights. In Stroud, where I live, we've got several hundred hectares of what's called common land, Minchinhampton Common. And in fact, the freehold of the land is owned by a kind of community land trust called the National Trust, which is a body of 3 million members.
Yes.
And they own 300 or 400 stately homes and 1,500 farms. Anyway, they own the freehold of the commons, but we have the right to walk there, to walk our dogs, to fly our kites. There's a golf course there, you know, the right to play golf. There are commoners, kind of farmers and smallholders around the common, who have the right to graze cows there. Not sheep, but cows. There's sites of special scientific interest. You know, so certain areas are cared for specially by wildlife bodies. And what else? Yeah, there's the road. There's one or two roads across the commons, and 40 miles an hour restrictions, because cows, of course, are a bit threatened by cars. That's a big issue. And the governance has provided that there's a set of rules for users of the commons, and there's a commons body that manages the whole commons. So it sounds quite complicated, doesn't it?
Well, this is one of the things we're looking for, simple and less stress. So if you can help us down this road, it'd be wonderful.
it's not complicated, really, because we all know how to manage the commons. So if a dog walker doesn't pick up their dog muck, they get...
fined.
Reminded,
yes.
You know.
Mm.
It's not just fined, but, you know, people say, you know, ooh.
Yeah, clean up the mess.
So it's self-governing,
yes.
You know, so it's very little cost of governing, because we all know the rules, and there's various groups of people that kind of supervise it, unpaid, voluntarily.
Yes.
And it all works for the benefit of the environment and people and the farmers. So that's an example of commons governance. So a community land trust is a similar kind of commons governance, and the aim is to own land and property in trust for... and to capture the value of that for the benefit of the community. So we a group of us went to America in 2003 and looked at places like Burlington, Vermont, where Mayor Bernie Sanders, you know, he became the senator. He helped pioneer their wildlife community land trusts and their housing community land trusts. And so I think in Burlington, Vermont, they've got 3,000 houses owned by their community land trust, which of course owns the land on which these houses stand. And it's made affordable by, you can buy houses at two-thirds or half the market value, because the other half of the value is held by the land trust. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's a part purchase.
Yes.
You don't have to buy the land. All you buy is a structure. So that's one way of doing it. And I think it's a great model. It works. And if councils, if the state gives subsidies or grants, they are retained by the land trust, which delivers permanent affordability. So, yeah, so we started up one in Stroud. And again, we developed exemplars in 6-8 places in the UK. And now there's 225 and growing, because every community wants their community land trust.
Well, this is good news. We don't hear a lot about this here in New Zealand, because we're busy doing what we need to do here, and whatever news we get over from overseas usually is the news we don't want to hear.
Right, yeah. I mean, from your description of this cooperative New Zealand world you described, I'm sure you will have really good examples, relatively unknown examples dotted around, of what might be called community land trusts, you know, by another name.
Could be. We have got an eco-village here called Earth Song.
Yeah.
And a place called Ranui in West Auckland. And all I do know is that when I have been there and walked into the buildings, because they've been made so wonderfully from a standpoint of, you go in and you just feel this real deep connection and warmth inside
right.
them. And so, yes, there's a lot out there. It's just, again, we're not privy to all the information.
Yeah. And what we did in our, when we got funding for our Community Land Trust national demonstration project, we got funding from the government, and we found, for example, that Letchworth Garden City, which was the pioneer in Garden City, Ebenezer Howard had this vision of basically a community land trust. He called them cooperative land societies, and they leased the land for business premises or housing, or he had farms all the way around Letchworth that were owned by the Letchworth Heritage Trust. And so that model was built into the Garden City movement. But they'd forgotten it, you know. They'd forgotten, actually, that it was built on land trusteeship.
Yes, it's the memory. Lots of people just need to realise that all sorts of things have happened. In 1973, the New Zealand Labour government, their manifesto allowed for a thing called ohus, which is a Māori word for being able to have a little area of land to be able to grow a cooperative community.
Amazing.
And yes, then they put it out to people, and in 1973, I mean, as an extension of the flower power revolution that that came in 1967, yes, which you will know a little bit about too.
Yeah, what I can remember of it, Tim.
I'm glad that you can remember something. I can tell you stories about that. But,
yeah.
But how it was that a lot of the people who went to the land would have been described as hippies, and they had the ideals, but they didn't have the finance
or the skills.
And there's no computers to help them set it all out. And this is what we need again, is a brave and courageous government to just lay out an opportunity for just to get a few pioneers up and running and see where it takes us.
And the learning from the Ohu cooperative opportunity, there needs to be technical assistance, consultancy, facilitation from people who know what they're doing. I mean, I think your wonderful Prime Minister, Norman Kirk, is that right?
That was him, yes.
Yes, memorable. Didn't he bring your troops back from Vietnam and, you know, various things like that?
He sent a frigate out into the nuclear test zone in Moruroa in French Polynesia to stop the French from testing bombs.
Yeah, amazing. Adam bombs. What's an example? But didn't he build his own house? I think he built his own house.
Yes. That may have slipped by me by now. This is the memory thing.
he did.
Yes.
And you know, you're a pioneer. Is it number 8 wire folk?
Yes, we do gaff tape now.
Oh, you do gaffer tape?
Yes. Yeah. We've moved up a little. I'm speaking with Martin Large from the UK, who has been involved in many cooperatives, many small businesses and community land trusts in assisting people to get back on the land, get back into housing, get back into small business and making a difference when you're connected as community and having a deep relationship with the earth and your common surroundings.
Okay, and I'll give you an example in Cornwall in England. The Cornwall Community Land Trust, it's a county community land trust, and it's given technical assistance by their, I think you call them housing trusts still here. We call them housing associations. So they built 400 houses, and one great scheme is in a resort where the average house price is, you know, $1.5 million Australian dollars.
I hear you.
you know, that sort of, and rising, and a lot of them are empty half the year, of course. And so, and local folk couldn't live anymore in their village. So a local landowner sold the land at an agricultural price, which would have been 10,000 an acre, rather than if it had building planning permission, it would cost much more, of course. So he kind of sold way below market price to the land trust. And then they developed a 16-home scheme that whereby the land was kept in the land trust, and these self-built homes only cost $100,000 to build.
Yes, that's another thing, keeping the price down.
Yeah. So they got the 16 self-builders that, you know, they each had a template for the housing. They could get a mortgage for $100,000.
Yes.
And each time they resell, if they need to move on and sell their home, all the price they get is the cost of the structure on the land and not the land. So their selling price, I think, would be on average 66% less than the market price. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that because the land is such a high component of the house, of the property cost. Is that clear to you how that works?
Sort of. I'm not the greatest mathematician in the world.
Yeah.
But thank you, because we can take this further.
Yeah.
I'm sure that there are others who, in New Zealand, who are involved in intentional community of sorts, that they can run with this.
So it's not an intentional community, this one.
Okay. You know,
it's a housing land trust scheme, and these 16 homeowners, they own the structure on the land. But when they sell those homes, those individual homes, it's got to be at only 33% of market value.
Okay. Yeah, well, there's so much we can do. I know it's also been able to get your own clay virtually out of your own backyard if you want to make rammed earth.
Yeah, that's right.
And these are the opportunities that are available, and I'm constantly looking at different ways and being able to build my own house, and from resources that I can obtain very locally. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the other thing that's happened in the UK is we've got market failure in housing. So the house builders will only build high-end or medium-end housing that they can make a profit on. They won't build housing for moderate-income people or low-income people. So it's market failure. And there's also state failure, that our government is actually not honouring the right to decent, affordable and well-designed housing. You know, it may be there in theory, but it's not there in terms of implementing it. So that's where the land trust comes in. But on your question about, you know, designs, our Stroud Community Land Trust, it's called the Cashes Green Community Land Trust, we were really, really fortunate that Kevin McLeod of Grand Designs, do you know of him here?
Not familiar, no.
He's on television with Grand Designs.
I don't have TV.
You don't have TV?
No.
Okay, well,
yep.
Like one program a week, Kevin does on house design,
okay.
Building your own home. Anyway, he had this outfit called, an architectural design outfit called Happiness, Architecture and Beauty. And okay. He designed this whole 78-home scheme very environmentally, you know, low energy. And so that's a bit of an exemplar. And so these community land trusts can do what, you know, can use materials affordably, or the latest materials, or Scandinavian-type designs as well. And that's important as well.
Yes. Yeah, well, way back in about 1936, the New Zealand Labour government at the time managed to build 33,000 new homes, and they internalised the debt. They didn't have to go overseas, and they found a way, and we had state houses. And you'll find in just about every major city in New Zealand a part of the town or a suburb where there are just state houses. Now, where they dropped the ball was that they didn't upgrade the design of the house all the time. And if they'd really got savvy and had real good design, like we get very good design, quite spacey or spatial.
Yeah.
And you think, gee, if that's going to be my house, you're proud of it. And when we're proud, that word pride and proud, it's problematic at one level. But when you're happy to go home, you're also happy to make sure that the shrubs are in place, the garden's all done, there's flowers, there's veggies, and you're house proud.
Exactly. And one good example of a city in the UK providing what you call state housing, we call council housing, Redditch near Birmingham. It was a Labour council, and they realised they no longer had the skills for efficient, cost-effective, well-designed, new-build council or state housing. And the housing associations, or housing trusts, I think you call them, were all in London, and they were worried about the local social housing stock being sold off in Redditch and the money being used elsewhere. So they set up Redditch Cooperative Homes as a three-way partnership with a cooperative housing association and with the community and the council. And they've built 400 or 450 tenant cooperative homes, and they've used a design from Norway, prefabricated, low energy, space standards to die for, people with disabilities friendly, I don't know the right word. But they were only able to do that because they had cut loose from the usual system.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's so much opportunity, Martin, for us to be able to start communicating. We've got no problems now. Telephones can make us be in touch instantly across time and space. Skyping programs to be able to even do a YouTube of easy how to do this and that. But I still maintain one of the things is that a lot of people are just struggling to pay the bills, because we've got a situation here, say in Auckland, where the house prices have gone up $400,000 to $500,000 in the last 5 years, but their wage or salary has basically stayed the same. And, and these are the things that need to be articulated to inspire us to take it to the next level, which you are offering us.
Yes, I mean, the caution, the health warning is, I mean, I'm astonished that house prices have gone up 400 or 500% in Auckland. Is that over how many years?
Maybe four to five to six or seven.
Right. Yes. I mean, no democratic society can survive that kind of inequality, and it's and also poverty as well. And what you've got is a first-rate housing bubble, haven't you?
An extreme bubble at the moment, because we've got also outside. People can come in from overseas and buy land and do land banking, and this is what they're doing.
Yeah.
And artificially blowing up everything.
But as a democracy, as citizens and the government have created a set of rules allowing people to do that. So your rules, your regulations, your laws about land and planning have actually facilitated that bubble. So on the macro level, on the national level, you know, you need to have a serious conversation about planning and land access, otherwise that bubble will continue and inequality will get worse. The big issue I've come across is intergenerational inequality, and so these young people who are building tiny houses, which is a healthy reaction to a pathological land system.
So true. Yes, we have got this major challenge. One of the problems is a lot of the poor have had their houses price go up $400,000 or $500,000 as well. And for the first time in their life, they think, gee, I'm nearly a millionaire.
Yes.
And they're not rocking the boat because of their interests in wanting to keep this money. So it's a double bind in many ways.
Because we're speculating on the housing casino. That those of us who have got houses. And however, the big question is how to bring the price of housing and land down through treating it as a commons. What's happened is that land, which is, as Winston Churchill said, is the mother of all monopolies, isn't it? So what's happened is that land, which is a commons, has been treated like a commodity to be bought and sold on the market. And this, through planning regulations and through taxes like charging stamp duty, higher rates of stamp duty or capital gains tax or inheritance taxes, you know, on land, then this bubble will continue until there's a crash, which is also not healthy. So my question would be how are you going to have a national conversation about land?
Yes, that is a real big one at the moment, and I've noted in some of the situations you have a rich landowner who's had a full life and they don't really want to capitalise a gain on selling their land off. They want to be able to donate it more to a cooperative or community. And this is the gift. Well, fortunately, there are rich people also who have good hearts.
I think that's really, really important, and I hope my comments aren't making people defensive, because I think we need to separate out individuals from you know, the structure of rules and regulations that are creating the land bubble. I met, for example, I met a really, I didn't know, I did some work, consultancy work for a biodynamic farmer, and I talked a bit about land farmland trusts and Fort Hall Farm that I've already mentioned, and she gave me £1 million to start up a biodynamic farmland trust. And it was amazingly generous, wasn't it?
Well, this is the beauty of it. You never can tell.
No.
We cannot tell. And, yeah. And we have to be able to take that trust that they give us and make it work.
That's right. So yeah, exactly. And you know, it's a long, long, long way to implement the vision. So I'm here in New Zealand at the invitation of Carolyn Hughes of the Land Trust New Zealand, which is hopefully will secure lands, for example, land in Auckland for a market garden, a biodynamic market garden, an educational and health facility, and for bees. But I hope, I think Carolyn hopes that over the course of time, that such people as you describe, philanthropic people, will give their land to the land trust for stewarding and leasing, particularly to young farmers. So that's her vision.
It's a good one. It's a wonderful one.
Well, I'll tell you the story. I'd like to tell you the story of when we were looking at farm succession. And in UK, the average age of farmers is 60 to 65. Is that similar here?
In New Zealand, in Australia, in America, it was all around about 65 to 67. And yes, they don't know what to do because their children don't really want the 24/7 responsibilities of a scientific farm.
Yes, exactly. So, anyway, so we had this succession workshop. Some people came over from France because they were setting up a farmland trust in France as well, which they've successfully done. And this diminutive, more elderly woman with a cut glass accent, like the Queen.
Okay.
She came. I won't imitate her. She said, I'd like a few words with the conference after lunch. And she said, well, I own 13 farms in Leicestershire, she said, and I'm childless. And so she's giving them to the Soil Association Land Trust.
Yay, this is fantastic.
Isn't that amazing?
It is.
And you know Beatrix Potter, the author?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, Peter Rabbit. She bought a lot of Lake District farms in Cumbria in northwest England in the 20s and 30s. And when she died, she left them to the National Trust.
I think I've heard of that somewhere.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, you know, you go to the Lake District and a lot of the land is actually in trust. So New Zealand can do this. And so I think farm trusts, trusteeship bodies, charitable cooperative bodies, as well as community land trusts for housing, and develop this philanthropic process of people giving to their community, or, you know, that can certainly work. However, I think the government, through the democratic process, you do need a set of wiser rules. For example, why should absentee owners be allowed to own houses and keep them empty, or own farms and not actually run them? I think in Denmark, if you own a farm, you've actually got to live on it or near it, you know? So, you know, that's a big challenge, isn't it?
Well, it is. When New Zealand was essentially taken over by the liberal ideology back from the sort of mid-80s,
yes.
What happened is it just opened up the whole game, and for a wee while, New Zealand was classified as the most open country on earth, and this is why a lot of big money's coming in and buying hillside or gigantic farms in the South Island. We need to find another way around this one because New Zealanders are becoming tenants in their own country.
Exactly. I mean, I met this, you know, I had a beautiful trip around Golden Bay. Wonderful.
And yes.
Visiting some sacred Maori sites.
Which
were memorable. But we met an overseas investor. He was making a film about how wonderful New Zealand was for his compatriots. So he had a whole film team with him. He'd come to New Zealand because his daughter came to university here. I think he was a shipping broker, but initially when I asked him what his job was, he said, I'm in property, which to me meant property speculation. And he'd bought a 600-acre farm. He didn't know how to farm. And the story went on.
That's
He's
right.
not a farmer.
Yes.
And if he sits on that farm for 10 years, the price of that farm will double, won't it, at least?
Easily. And if it gets... If you have challenges out in the Northern Hemisphere with whatever there may be, New Zealand's the bolt hole for the rich and famous.
That's right. So, you know, I was thinking, what kind of country is it that allows this? And it, I don't think he was paying any taxes either.
That's true.
You know, I was thinking, well, this is... Who's thinking about this in New Zealand? Who's thinking this through?
Thank you for bringing this up, because I think this is another level of how we need to... We need to superimpose another structure that's based on a win-win-win for everybody that has a new feel towards it. What I'm endeavouring to language here, Martin, is that the old hasn't worked. We have to superimpose the new paradigm.
Yes, and the new is happening everywhere. Have you ever interviewed Greg Hart of Mangarara Farm?
I have stayed at his place. I've been driven all over the farm with the dogs, and I have stayed in the lodge, and I did an interview of Greg about 2 months ago. So, yes, Greg's another brother who's really wanting to find a way to work cooperatively with so many people.
He's a great farmer, and you know, he had one or two young farmers there with him who are also great farmers. But how do they get land access to farms? So on the one hand, you've got these people who are great New Zealand farmers in your farming tradition. And on the other hand, you've got people who've got no training in farming, who don't know how to run a farm business, who are not going to live on the farm, just buying it because it's stuff there that's like gold bricks.
That's right. So, yes, so this is a challenge. And so what would be, Martin, for you to leave some gold nuggets for New Zealanders to be able to open up a new way of being able to cooperate, to work together, to really set the template in a planetary perspective for our children and grandchildren?
Well, firstly, consider developing a community land trust program for affordable and decent housing. So every community, you know, so that, you know, to pilot that nationally and locally. Secondly, to have a conversation around what kind of farming you want, you know, how, you know, and how to secure really green and sustainable and regenerative farming.
Regenerative is a very important word.
Yes, because people come from all over the world to see this beautiful, wonderful country of New Zealand. But how green is it really? And can farmers develop a regenerative farming that actually will earn you more money, if you see what I mean, because it's producing healthier food and restoring rural communities as well. So those two things. And the third thing, how can you rebalance your society? So at the moment, you've got this pendulum between the state, you know, more state is the answer, or the market. The corporates, more you know, more businesses in the market. How can you rebalance society so the civil society, plural sector, all the NGOs, Project Littletons, churches, all the, you know, all these whole rainbow of organizations that we call the plural sector, how can the plural sector balance the public sector and the corporate private sector? Because at the moment, the people of New Zealand are being kind of squeezed out. Yeah. So those three things.
Yes, very good, Martin. Because we would like to have more input from overseas, because a higher or an overview of a country can allow us to see what needs to be reconnected, yeah, redefined, reclarified. And so I'm so pleased that you've been able to come here, because you're also extremely embedded in new agriculture, but you've got a business background too, so you understand that once we use money correctly and cooperatively and work together, we definitely can, shall we say, be a visionary for the future of who we are.
I would say that I've come to here to learn, you know, and I think that you've got exemplars here to learn from, you know, and you've got people here, you know, all over the place, in government, in business, in civil society, who are very visionary and also very skilled, and it's probably a matter of growing your own solutions, and us, things like UBI and the Land Trust New Zealand, and us learning collaboratively across the planet.
I think that's a key word, collaborative, planetary, people just realising that we're all in this together, we all share the same breath, we've got a future at the moment we're looking at that really needs a total change in consciousness globally if we are to save the day, for want of a better word.
And your Maori wisdom is great. I met somebody called Mike who said to me, "We are the land and the land is us. I am the land and the land is me. If you look after the land, it'll look after you. And if others succeed, you succeed." And I think health is spiritual, soul, physical. So you've got this wonderful wisdom here to draw on, don't you?
We do. Anyone visiting New Zealand and meeting a Maori after Kia Ora, talking about Mother Earth, Papatūānuku, all the Maoris will respond. They know that Papatūānuku exists, loans them a free body, free air, free water, and until recently a free food chain. So, yes, we have got so much in the way of drawing from the indigenous peoples. Martin, believe it or not, we're out of time.
Well, thank you.
Yes, I really appreciate your time, the fact that you've gone to so many people and groups throughout New Zealand. And we would like to have a website, any website, that we can connect with you.
Okay.
What would the website be?
One website is www.communitylandtrusts.org.uk.
Okay. Well,
that's one website. And then Land Trust New Zealand for the New Zealand Farm Trust work.
That's www.thelandtrustnz.com. Thelandtrustnz.com. Excellent. Well, Martin, thank you very much. All really important what you're doing. I watched a video, about a 41-minute one, where you were in a tent and there was sirens in the background. I thought I heard dog barking. I thought it was you had to perform in a circus. And you did well. You did well. And so, well, look, thank you once again. I really trust that you are able to get the snowball rolling in New Zealand, and we look forward to wonderful change here.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim.
Okay, then.
Well, Tim, it's great talking with you. You're running a great radio station.
Well, it's a program. I love a radio station. But thank you. And there's greenplanetfm.com. There is so much in the way of... I've interviewed all sorts of community groups.
Yeah.
And we need to continue it.
But as a publisher of books, I think, you know, the art of interviewing is a fantastic way of also doing follow-up books. So, you know.
I'll be in touch because I've done publishing myself as well.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay.
Thank you again.
Yeah. May your crops grow well and your children and projects flourish.
Excellent. Thank you again.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. That was Martin Large from the UK. I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 400 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world. And become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on greenplanetfm.com and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch.
And or Lisa Eyre.
And Liz Gunn.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say kia kaha and haere ura.